Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. My guest today is Mariana Copland. Mariana has spent over two decades researching and practicing many of the world's great mystical traditions. She's a professor of yogic and transpersonal psychologies and has authored seven books in the fields of psychology and spirituality. Welcome to Conversations, Mariana.
Thank you.
It's great to get together with you. I love your book. And I just want to start out with defining what we mean by spirituality, because a lot of times people talk about it, but it's mixed up with religion or yoga. Or what do you mean when you talk about spirituality?
Well, one of the first chapters in the book is, what is spirituality anyway? So the point of a title and a chapter like that is to not rush and assume that we know what spirituality is or that we all mean the same thing when we say it. Mm-hmm. But roughly, I would describe spirituality as not limited to any particular tradition, but religious tradition, but often at the esoteric or mystical core of most religions. And I'm hesitant to define it too much, as much as to suggest that in each of us, many of us access a kind of longing for something deeper. And I'm content that people discover what spirituality is for themselves. The more years I'm involved with it, the more content I am to let people long and search and define and hopefully redefine what that might be. So I'm not trying to evade the question as much.
No, that's great. I remember when I was a kid and I heard a song, Is That All There Is was the name of the song. Mm-hmm. It was like Patti Page or somebody like that. And I remember thinking about that sometimes later in my life, remembering that song, and the path kind of unfolded out of what you were saying, a longing for something, for something more. I've never quite found a direct path. It seems to be very like bouncing off the walls, but it often comes out of a place of discontent, that there must be something other than this. I think that's true for many people, that the search begins with a place of pain or discontent or some kind of suffering.
Yeah, I teach transpersonal psychology at graduate school, and just Monday night I was sharing with my students just this very thing, that very often the urge for the path comes out of a certain woundedness or a certain breaking or cracking. And it could be the way that we were raised. Sometimes people have religious wounding, and sometimes it can be an illness or death or shock. And once in a while, you find some really psychologically healthy, well-rounded people who are also interested in spirituality.
Isn't that amazing?
I've met at least three of them. And I was also sharing with the class that part of the challenge, because it's often that wound or that crack or that trauma that brings us to the path, a lot of people who find themselves involved in spiritual traditions are also coming with a certain kind of psychological trauma. And that's not bad in itself, but it adds another degree of complexity to spiritual paths and communities and practitioners and teachers, because it's often that very break that broke us open to the drive. But just because we find the path certainly doesn't mean that the psychological wound or the neurotic aspect goes anywhere. We bring it right with us to the path.
I really love in the book, Eyes Wide Open, your book, that the way you bring together the spiritual, the psychological, and the karmic into kind of a whole gestalt, a whole view of that in your search for discernment and finding that. Talk about the relationship that you see between, maybe explain what you mean by karma, but also about the inner relationship that you see there.
Yeah. So I started doing all of these spiritual seeking and practices when I was hardcore when I was 19, and I've been doing it ever since. And early on in there, in my early 20s, I got a master's degree in counseling, because already at that point I was feeling, I was down in Central America with the shamans and seeing that there in myself and in all of these other people there was some psychological component that was making the ride bumpier than it needed to be. At the time I was a Buddhist when I was studying psychology, but I went and deepened much further into spiritual traditions, and now, you know, a decade or more later, came back to really deepen my knowledge another level in psychology. So my conviction at present, and I hope to be someone whose convictions are never so sturdy that they can't be undermined.
Right,
I would
now.
Be happy to be here a year from now saying, well, my conviction has changed and because I saw something I hadn't seen before. But I suspect this one's going to stay for a while. And in the Western world, there's a particular constellation of a Western psyche, and a lot of what we're dealing with in spiritual traditions are Eastern imports. So those Eastern imports, as objective as the spiritual truths might be in them, don't account for the Western psyche and all of the cultural, ecological, present time conditions, all the various conditions that inform our psyche. And they couldn't take them into account. So I have a deep conviction that spirituality needs psychology in the Western world.
It almost becomes fundamentalist if you don't add that component, especially bringing something from the East when you've got our Western cultural neuroses of a consumer heaven is where many people are striving to reach attainment.
Yeah, fundamentalist, and it's just incomplete. It's just incomplete. It doesn't account for all the variables of the human psyche, and if we're talking about these vague principles of awakening or maybe more simply learning to be effective or happy or of service, there's a very important variables that have to be taken into account. And if we don't take into account the psyche of a particular culture, I think the path is just going to be incomplete. And researching paths and teachers, and because of the nature of the books I've written, I'm like a dumping ground for spiritual gossip and scandal. It just all has come to me over the last 20 years, and I know things I wish I didn't know, and I hold them, you know, I hold them carefully, but I've studied that because I've heard so much over the years, and from there I see that as Westerners we have to bring in, we have to acknowledge the Western psyche and the wounds that are pertinent in our culture.
Well, that brings us to something that you talked about in the end of your book, and that was the finding a spiritual teacher. But I think that's not a bad place to begin, because spiritual teachers have egos too, and attractions, obviously. And how do we find a match with a teacher that fits our longing and our direction that you know, we can feel safe with? I guess it's really going to the place of, how do I feel safe?
Yeah, so we're hitting big topics here, right? Mm-hmm. Karma, psychology, teacher. I'm going to complete the last bit.
Oh, the karma, that's right.
Just
I was going to come
somebody
back around to that.
Saying, well, what about the karma?
This is in the feminine model, you see.
Great, I'm all for it. Karma's a big, big topic. The word is totally overused. And at the same time, about 15 years ago, I said to myself, I want to know something about karma, like universe, like give me, like take me somewhere to teach me something about it. And I've talked to people who know something about it, and the people who I talk to who know most about it say that, I mean most about it in the Western world, say themselves like they have barely scratched the surface of what karma could be. These are the greatest adepts in karma. There was something that two different female Buddhist teachers explained to me about karma and its relationship to psychology that was enormously helpful to me. And it goes something like this, that whatever karma is, and each person is just going to have to sense into that. Whatever it is, I don't think it's linear, like, you know, I don't like the color of your shirt, so tomorrow somebody criticizes the color of my shirt. I don't think karma is nearly as linear as we think. I think it's a law. I think it is, regardless of whether we decide to believe in it or not. But whatever our view of karma or lifetimes, the way that these teachers explained it to me is however consciousness is constellating and reconstellating over timeless time, basically the situation of our birth, the place that we were born, the people who we were born to, the country in which we were born into, the socioeconomic class, the historical time we were born into, it was very, very specific, and it's specific to each one of us. Right? Each one of us has a particular circumstance like that. And those factors are going to be what create our psyche or our psychology. It's going to be largely influenced by mother, father, and then the family from there and the larger situations. And it helps for me to reduce karma or bring it to a practical level, and that's to say that whatever those vast karmic circumstances are have now come to fruition in ourselves, in our psyche, in our psychological predicaments. It's come to fruition in this lifetime, so rather than having to worry about past lives and what happened and resolving issues back then, whatever all of that was is here now. And if we deeply engage ourselves in the path in an honest way and in a non-bypassing way, I'm sure we'll talk about that before the end of this conversation, then we will meet our karma just going through our lives and paying attention and through our psychology. And that's where karma shows up simply as our own psychology. And it's much more than that, no doubt, but it made it very practical for me in a way that
I like the practical. Well, I like that about all your work, that it is very practical. Mm-hmm. For me, the question of past lives or not is a question that I think I've overcome that question in a way. That it's interesting, and there's a huge amount of evidence out there of people being born with scars, or they were bound and it showed up in the next time, or through the Dalai Lama and the Karmapa, and there's all this kind of evidence, but that is a very linear approach. Mm-hmm. To me, karma seems to be a valuable insight into right livelihood, into mm-hmm. discovering your own direction. I mean, we'd also have individual karma, and then relational karma, familial karma, cultural karma, mm-hmm. human karma. I mean, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you think of the karma we're doing to the earth right now mm-hmm. as a species, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where is that going to go? It's mm-hmm. not right livelihood, for mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's going to have an impact mm-hmm. on us all the way to the back to the individual level. Mm-hmm. So I like keeping it amorphous, and yet there's something about thinking that the things that I do in this life right now, the relationship that I have with you mm-hmm. at this mm-hmm. time, mm-hmm. the integrity of that and the authenticity of that somehow opens a path that wouldn't be there otherwise. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of my sense yeah. of that. Is that yeah. relating to what you're saying?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and it's your own take.
And it's my own, yeah. And everybody has an own take on it.
Yeah, I have no problem with that.
Being rigid around something that's so hard to measure like that mm-hmm. is... again, it's the area of closing down, and I think that's a big part of the path is the opening up. Mm. So mm-hmm. let's go back to opening up to teachers.
Okay.
Because I think that's an area fraught with minefields.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about what your experience is and some of your insights into that.
Okay, so my doctoral dissertation was a book that I wrote called Do You Need a Guru? Understanding the Student-Teacher Relationship in an Era of False Prophets. My publisher, Sounds True, is going to do a fully revised version next year. Mm-hmm. So the topic is never far away. And I published that book 7 years ago, and even in those 7 years, when I think about the new edition of that book, the biggest point that I'm going to make is that it is a subject of such complexity and such subtlety and nuance and individual experience. It's fraught with complexity. It is a minefield. And yet, I don't know about you seem like a pretty kind of adventurous person. If there was something I wanted enough on the other side of the minefield and I had some decent guidance, I probably would step out into it if I thought what was going to be on the other side was worthwhile or not.
Well, there's that whole aspect of not being able to see your own face. Mm-hmm. And that somehow to have someone to be able to hold a mirror up is a really powerful thing in any kind of growth situation. But then there's also, every teacher also has an ego and a psyche and their own neuroses that get played out in that interplay, which could also be a karmic interplay. It is a karmic interplay there. So tell us about discernment, though, in terms of choosing that teacher. You know, I mean, for me, it's more a matter of my gut, and I stay there as long as I feel like the energy's going up, and if I feel the energy going down, I'm out of there. But that's my own kind of physical. I think there's a big part of my discernment that that's physical because of the work that I do.
Yeah. So discernment, which is the subject of the whole book, is really about learning the questions and not just learning what they are, but really learning them, learning the questions, learning how to ask questions, learning what we're looking for, learning the blindnesses in ourselves, learning the influences that are operating, the psychological unconscious variables that are going on with ourselves in relationship to the path. So for you, you know, you have this body measurement in your gut, but as my life goes on and I appreciate the complexity more, we are armed. Like, discernment is like this grand protection, but it's something that's cultivated, and it's cultivated by years of diligent self-study, what my teacher Lee Loswick calls ruthless self-honesty. So not everybody is going to have a teacher, not everybody's going to want a teacher, and many people do want a teacher. Some people are going to have a teacher for their whole lifetime. Some people are going to have many teachers during their lifetime. And in the earlier book, Do You Need a Guru? I mean, there's huge sections of the book just devoted to what kinds of questions you're looking to ask. But in the new book, I divided the chapter into three sections, and the first was about the spiritual possibilities of having a teacher, and the next was about the psychological challenges of having a teacher, and the third section was about the psychological challenges of being a teacher. So just to touch on each of those briefly, there are certain possibilities available through having a teacher that are unique to having a teacher. You mentioned the piece about not being able to see your own face. That's like a recognition that the egoic mechanism, which is pretty much who we think we are all the time, or almost all the time, is such a self-contained structure that it's very hard for anything to pierce it. So if you have a reliable, trustworthy spiritual authority, that's the big question. How do you find a reliable, trustworthy spiritual authority? But there's a possibility to have this structure penetrated in ways that we might not be able to do for ourselves. There's the possibility of transmission, and transmission is the passing on of the living flame of truth from one person to another. And we all know that experience, even just from maybe a musician that we love or a concert, right? It's very different hearing that, Bob Dylan wrote this great song and we think it's good. And then you hear it, in your car stereo, and then you're in the presence of, and something, right, something penetrates. That's transmission, and it's the same principle with spirituality. There's a possibility to pass on sparks of truth person to person that's quite unique to
now,
the function of a teacher.
Are you talking about, well, probably all of them, but energetic or cognitive or some awakening in the heart, or, when you say transmission, I mean, that could be a lot of different things.
Yeah, but I think of all the words you used, energetic, or it's the words may be used, but it's something internal and alive. And people are very different. So some people
it takes a life in you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And some people who are much more cognitively based, it may take the form of insight, and somebody who's body based, it may take the form of a sensation. But it's living. It's the passing of a living spark of truth. So then we come to the psychological challenges of having a teacher. Are both, as you mentioned, the teacher is coming with their own psychological set of conditioning and their own egoic structure. Even if they've done a very good job working with it, there's probably still more to go. And that's meeting with our own psychological structure. And here we open into the labyrinth of projection. I think a good metaphor when we talk about the relationship with a spiritual teacher is the metaphor of human intimacy or partnership. Because often I think many of us would agree that when we're attracted to somebody, strongly attracted to somebody, and then we end up developing a relationship with that person there, and we're psychologically savvy a little bit.
A relationship as a teacher,
I'm using the metaphor as of two people. And you develop the relationship, right? The great spark brings you together, and then lo and behold, there's very complementary neuroses that emerge usually. And at some point you say, like, wow, there was something really essential that brought us together, and there's probably something really neurotic that brought us together. And I think the same can be true with a teacher. There's going to be often something really, really divine and really core that brings us together. Definitely karmic, for better and worse. And then often there's a deep psychological component. Often we're seeking a teacher both because we long for transmission and support in seeing the truth, and we need to be validated. We want to belong.
We want to be loved and accepted
and guided. And the fact that both of those polarities are there doesn't discount either of them. It's really both. But it can often take many years to really uncover what our own unconscious psychological needs are in that relationship. And then depending on how psychologically healthy the teacher is, how that's interplaying with their own process. And that's where we get into the complexities. Most of these teachers have had some genuine degree, and there's many degrees, but some genuine degree of spiritual awakening or insight. And again, there's like a vast variation in the degree of that insight, but they're also going to be on a spectrum of awareness in terms of their psychological blind spots. And then we have some degree of authentic spiritual longing and some degree of neurotic attraction to the path or teacher. And in each of these, right, each of these categories are vast, and then you're putting that cocktail all together. And you have a lot to pay attention to. And here is discernment. And discernment, unfortunately, you can't go to a weekend workshop to learn discernment. You might be able to go to learn pranayama or some new, you know, meditation technique. But discernment is it's cultivated, it's earned, it's labored for. One sheds tears and grovels and gets slammed on the ground and gets back up, and discernment is cultivated more like that in my experience.
It occurs to me that the whole idea of the path to enlightenment is a setup to keep us from the very value of the spiritual path, in that it's so often seen as a place to get to rather than the real work seems to be where we are right now. In this particular moment, you and I are sitting here, mm-hmm. we could have a spiritual epiphany mm-hmm. right here and deepen our awareness and our consciousness and have some kind of revelation even. But it's here and it's now. It's not someplace to get to. And I see that so much in the seeking world. It is a seeking world, often in the New Age sense of it. And it's like there's so much to do right here to just get present, that this path has no longer got the call to me that I think perhaps it once did, or maybe it never really. It's always been more about, okay, how can I be here? Mm. How can I love? How can I serve? How can I be real? How can I be authentic? So that whole area seems to be like a conundrum there, when the practice and the thing that I'm looking for in talking about a teacher is someone who can show me my own face in some way, that I can find the blind spot or the neuroses, very much like
the value of a relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, you continue to grow. Mm-hmm. Although no one tells you what it's going to be like when you start out, when you really, the thing that you really liked about someone right. now becomes the thing that really annoys you, yeah. and you wonder why. Any other thoughts about teachers before we move on to
okay,
some
other
area?
I thought we were on to enlightenment now.
Oh, enlightenment. Yeah, let's talk about enlightenment since that kind of flowed out of the conversation there. What do you think about that?
I don't think very much about it. So the previous book before this was about the error of premature claims to enlightenment. I've done a lot of dismantling of enlightenment. I think that largely the value of the idea of enlightenment, largely but not entirely, is defunct. It doesn't seem to do a lot of people a lot of good. And whatever that enlightenment is, a lot of people don't seem to, in my estimation, I mean, I've met and interviewed thousands of seekers and hundreds of teachers and some of the great ones, and what, less than a handful might meet my criteria of enlightenment. And that's not a problem for me. But once we're deeper into the path and the idea that I'm the most special spiritual practitioner that ever existed, and I'm going to be the one like Jesus and Buddha, once
that dissipates.
Which is
just more ego, of course.
Yeah, but it's also, right, it's the awakening of the spark, and you feel, not everybody, but many people, something awakens, and you taste it, and you sense in some way that you're not separate from that, and it starts you on the path. So it's ego, but it's always a mix. It's ego, and it's a very young, beautiful, pure awakening. But once the belief that I'm more special than everyone else fades, and it doesn't fade for a number of these wannabe teachers ever, but for many others it does, then there's just the rest of us. And that's where I think most of the practitioners, people dedicated to the path, whatever way they are, land somewhere like you're describing. Like, how do I love well? And how do I serve
Who
well?
Am I? Why am I here? What's truth? What's true and not
yeah,
true.
But even more practical, I think, as time goes on. How do I love well? And how yeah. do I serve well?
Yeah.
And yet, I've had some practitioners who I really respect argue this point with me in a way that is also compelling. And they say something to the effect of, if you don't conceive of a very, very profound degree of spiritual possibility for yourself, it's very unlikely you're gonna grow into that. There are very profound degrees of opening and awakening that's possible. The Buddha and, you know, all the Hindu scriptures, like, they're not off. I don't think that they're outdated or irrelevant. So I just want to say, I often find myself doing this when I argue strongly for one point, just to acknowledge the other,
yeah,
that because
but isn't that part of discernment too?
Yeah,
being
and we can always be
both.
Yeah, we can always fall off one side or the other. We disenlightenment too much. We may kind of forget the vision, yeah. and we get too caught in enlightenment, and then we're stuck in a goal that takes us away from the present that enlightenment's supposed to be about. But it's like that, like always balancing that, and always part of discernment is. Always questioning, and not questioning out of low self-esteem or self-doubt, but out of a profound respect for the greatness of the unknown, and humbling ourselves before it. Not because we think we're supposed to be humble, because that's what you do when you're on the spiritual path, but an appreciation as time goes on for the vastness and the complexity. And
I love the Rilke quote. I can't remember it right offhand.
Which
but the one?
One?
About living into the question,
yeah.
and perhaps someday you'll find that mm-hmm. answer, but yep. it's living with the question as
yeah.
something that's an open question, because yeah. we do close doors.
Right.
And I see that a lot in many different spiritual disciplines, that this is the way, mm-hmm. and all the doors are closed on any other possibility. Well,
right.
that shuts down other doors, I think, inside
right.
of us, that when we do that, when we don't keep the question open.
Right. So a little aside, based on what you said about the doors that can be shut, I mean, I end up working, a lot of the therapy clients that come to me are people who come with some kind of spiritual issue. We end up talking about mommy, daddy, relationship, sex, because so many things come down to that in the end, but they come with a spiritual issue about a path or practice or a lifetime of seeking and, you know, what was it all worth? The challenge with a lot of traditions and paths and practices is they become very dogmatic. Oftentimes we go to the path because spirituality, this idea of spiritual possibility, is different than the strong religious, rule-based, closed-minded religions that we came from. We come to the paths, but because we came from those religions and we come from the psyche and those wounds, a lot of those structures are recreated in the paths that we find ourselves in. And instead of leaving space for opening and endless questioning and individuals wrestling with their own ideas and needing to challenge the teacher and their ideas, they just become very rigidified. And it's a painful reality for me. And it becomes this separate we. And there's often a very subtle feeling that our path is just a little bit better or a lot than the other paths. Our way is a little bit more the way, even if we talk about there being many ways. And then it gets really specific. We eat like this, you don't eat this, you do eat this, you can dress like this, you can't dress like that, we don't talk like that. And it becomes codified and extremely limiting in the name of truth.
The spiritual teachers that I've met in my life in traveling around that I've been most attracted to have always been the ones that have almost a childlike innocence and sense of wonder and awe and curiosity. I love that. I'm attracted to that. Or a playfulness. My friend John O'Donohue passed away last year. He's a Jesuit priest, among other things. He would run up and he'd jump up in the air and he'd click his heels and then he'd look at flowers and he'd just sit there forever, and yet there was this beautiful childlike innocence. I often find in people who I really am attracted to as spiritual teachers, what do you find with the people that you've been involved in? Do you find that sense, or is that just because I'm attracted to that?
Yeah, I hear you, but I wouldn't for myself, I wouldn't limit it to that, because there's...
Oh, I'm not limiting it to it. But even, I think of the Dalai Lama, and I've watched him just be playful.
Right.
And this kind of lighthearted playfulness, and yet look at what he's carrying on his shoulders.
Right. But I'm receptacle, remember, for like spiritual tragedies and gossip and all of these things. So these same people that everybody watches clicking their heels, I hear about their depressions. I hear about the breakups of their marriages. I hear about what antidepressants they're taking. I hear about the drug bust of these same people. I'm not saying the people that you mentioned. So I hear that, and then we're dealing with human beings. And so I could imagine a teacher facing very painful illness and losing the innocence for some years. Or I've known great teachers who have gone through...
The dark night of the soul, the whole issue. We talked a minute ago just briefly about the wound, but I love in your book when you quote my favorite singer, Leonard Cohen, and that there's a crack.
Mine too.
There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
I mean, yes.
It's like, the first time I heard that, I went, yes! It's, let's talk about that area a little bit.
Yeah.
The dark side, the place that Rilke says, that you need to go into that and press against it and be with that dark place to find that light side also. What's your thoughts about that?
I was right with you, but not even necessarily to find the light side, but because that's just what we have to do.
Because it's there. It's in your face.
And because it's as much a half a life as the sun and the moon are complementing each other. It just is. Paths and practices that don't acknowledge the darkness, the human shadow, and even like spiritual shadow, I also find very, very incomplete. Paths that teach you transcendence at the cost of immanence, or value the light at the cost of the darkness, those are the traditions I tend to stay away from. And of course we can also swing the other way, because this is the road of discernment we're traveling. But I think that many of us, or most of us, are going to really encounter these situations in life, and I was calling it in the book the crack, And that crack can come in any number of ways. It often comes through relationship stuff and heartbreak. That's probably number one way that we're cracked. In fact, some of the Tibetan Buddhist lamas I've interviewed over the years, even in these three-year retreats where they're celibate, basically the largest reason for nervous breakdown among even lamas and great spiritual teachers are relationship issues. We get our hearts broken. That hits us more than anything. Our hearts get broken open and it hits the most primal childhood wounds of unlove and longing and forsaken by the divine. Nothing like heartbreak to crack us open. And after that, we get into the illness and people we love dying and accidents. And these things crack us, and I think they forge the soul in ways that nothing else does. And oftentimes, when you can get into this area with a lot of the great people and you get into an intimate space where some of the people we most admire and you hear about their nervous breakdown. No, oh, this great teacher couldn't have had a nervous breakdown for 3 years. Yes, they did. And they might not publicize it, but they're also probably not going to deny it in the right conversation. And sometimes they use it in talks. And it's usually those events that make us more human and more available and more empathic. Lama Paulden, she's a Tibetan Buddhist Lama psychotherapist, a friend, big sister of mine. She was saying, I interviewed her for this book, and she was saying that for some of the Tibetan Lamas, it's said that they are often incarnated into very difficult situations in this lifetime, both so that they can experience for themselves how one works through those experiences, so that they can instruct their students, and also so that they can relate. I had my own version of this where I cracked very deeply open, and in this particular moment, this was through illness and heartbreak cocktail, and I was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge to give a talk at the university, and really at the lowest I've ever been, and I had this experience unlike I ever had before, where I had a complete sense of oneness with all of the people in the world with mental disorders and all the people that were lost and all the people that were fallen and everything that was demented and broken. But it was a oneness experience. And I had, in all my years of meditation and retreats and yoga, I had never had an experience of oneness with darkness. And I'm really, really glad for that experience. And I'm glad to have broken that much. I'm sure my work as a therapist has been very much helped by that, because the spiritual path in the name of oneness can often separate us, right? It's like a little bit above, a little bit more special. And the being cracked reminds us of our unity. We're no different. We're in no better shape than the most vulgar, wretched, forgotten, forsaken, schizophrenic, borderline, crazy person. That's us too. And it becomes more than a concept. It becomes a recognition. And I think that if we're going to deal with ideas of oneness, like let's talk about oneness with everything, right? Oneness with the devastation of the environment and oneness with the suffering happening. Let's talk about oneness with everything that's happening in all parts of ourselves, right? We want to be at one with the whole and healed and beautiful parts of ourselves, but what about being one with the wounded and devastated parts of ourselves?
Camus says, live your life close to tears. Always live your life close to tears.
Mm.
And one of the things I see so much energy goes into, and as someone who works in the physical realm a lot with people, the amount of energy it takes to suppress the grief and the pain from some of those early incidents that we can't let up and feel that place of being. I was at Bioneers this weekend, and I was choking because I just was so deeply moved with some of the people that were speaking. I could feel that not wanting to let that up.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's something that any true path is going to bring you to that place against that place of tears, that place of grief. And in that connection with that place, it is a connection with the bigger grief that's suppressed in, you know, our entire humanity.
Yeah.
So I love that, the way you say that.
Yeah, and it's often hard to believe when we're in those spaces that that could be the fruition of our efforts. Yeah. Instead of a punishment or a fall from grace, that it could actually be that we're like able to be cracked open and broken open. I mean, it's happening anyway, but yeah. That it could actually be really
the hardest thing to me in the path is staying with it rather than either suppressing it or making it a story. My story. We all know people who have the story of how bad it was.
Yeah.
You know, and that keeps us from ever really realizing that depth of compassion with other people, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things you talked about also was our motivation, examining our motivation on the path. And I think that's along with all we've been saying, you know, why am I going on this path? What is it that's drawing me here? Sometimes it's really hard to discern what our real motivation is. Mm-hmm. How do you work with people when you're working to bring that out with people? How do you discover that with people?
One way that I encourage other people's self-honesty is to reveal it in myself. If we're talking about working with people, oftentimes when I do public work, the same way as I write, I don't pretend to be beyond any of this. And sometimes when you share these things about yourself and your own experience, then it's an easier way for people to say, oh, maybe me too. Maybe I did think that I wanted to, you know, that I was more special than everybody else. Or maybe I kind of did hope that if I did the spirituality, I'd be more attractive to men or women, or I would get that glow that I was after, or that more people would like me because I'd be radiant, or, you know, maybe I'm after yoga because I'm interested in self-knowledge and I want the yoga butt, right? and because in all of us, the motivations are going to be a weave of, you know, the holy and the unholy halves. And that's why when we examine our motivations, we also have to be really careful about how our psychological disposition is going to come into our motivation. For example, a lot of people are full of self-hatred. We all know that. Self-hatred is very hard to detect in oneself, even if you know that you're self-hating. So I have a really good friend in Mexico City, and a very well-known teacher was going to come down and visit and stay with her. And she has a very nice house, and the teacher couldn't come to visit. And she was saying to me on the telephone, she said, and I know why he didn't come. He didn't come because I started having these thoughts and feelings that, you know, I was the one getting to host him and that I was going to organize a visit and I was having too many self-centered thoughts. I said, that is not true. Like, that teacher could not come to visit you because that teacher is struggling with illness. And you had those thoughts because those are just thoughts that the mind kicks up, and your self-hatred is co-opting the spiritual teachings in order to once again do a spiritualized version of putting yourself down for everything you do. So it's often hard to examine our honest motivations, because when we reveal things that we wish weren't there, then these self-deprecating, self-hating mechanisms and judgments, just we go after ourselves for them. So it's a little bit complex. I mean, that's why I'll just do it for people, because I know that you and me and all my clients and most people, everyone I know on the path has a mixture of motivations, and I don't mind. I don't think they need to be pious or unpious, and I think weaker motivations, spiritual practices, good ones are very strong, and you bring those less holy motivations, and over time, practice refines some of them and reveals them, and the practice is not supposed to take us up to the sky. It's supposed to show us who we are, which is a combination of all these things. So it's like part of the discernment is the capacity for increasing levels of self-honesty. And we're not always going to be able to get to them ourselves, too. So sometimes there's the time to really go to somebody who you trust, who has the capacity, and say, what am I not seeing about myself? And being careful of who we're going to ask, not just asking the person that's going to say, oh, it was really great, but maybe you could. Right? The kind of friends who could say, yeah, good work. And you know, you were kind of showing off over there, and And yeah, you're knowledgeable, but did you really have to like throw that bit over there? And
we have such a conspiracy with each other, I think,
yeah.
In that area, that I won't call you on yours if you don't call me on mine, kind of thing. And it puts people in an awkward position sometimes when we ask them that, but to let them know that we really do want to know, and it would be helpful if you could both say it and I could hear it.
Yeah.
Both would grow out of that. Let's talk about another area. Let's talk about relationships. Didn't you just do a play about relationships?
I did. And after writing all these spiritual books, that's really fun.
I wish I'd have seen that. But tell us about that play and about what you were wanting to reveal to your audience and to yourself in doing that play.
Well, the play is called Zen Boyfriends. The thing about Zen Boyfriends is they just don't want to die. So I originally wrote a book chapter for an anthology, and one part of that chapter was about my experience in dating spiritual guys in my early 20s. And that little bit of the chapter hit something in the culture, and it hasn't left. So Tricycle Magazine published it, and then it circled around the world, and people were reading about Zen Boyfriends in Italy and in Spain and in France. And so this article kept living on. And then a few years ago, a guy named Mark Steiner, a high school music teacher in Oregon, wrote to me and said, can I convert this into a musical? And he did, and I went up to see it, and I was really impressed. And then I got his permission to reproduce it, and I continued to refine it and add on. Basically, when you watch a show, mostly you just laugh. It's really funny, but it has a point to it. And the principle behind it is spiritual bypassing. That's one of the chapters in my book. And spiritual bypassing is a term coined by my author friend John Wellwood. It refers to the way that we use spiritual concepts, ideas, and practices to bypass or avoid dealing with issues of low self-esteem or a shaky sense of self. We use spirituality to bypass dealing with ourselves, with our wounds, with intimacy, with life. So a Zen boyfriend is defined as a man who skillfully uses his spiritual ideas and practices as an excuse for his terror of any type of real relationship with a woman. And I'm a girl, right? So I wrote about boyfriends, but it's not a one-sided.
Equally, yeah.
We started talking about cafe gratitude girlfriends or yogini girlfriends. So the play was intentionally one-sided. And it's really just a play on something that actually happens. Like from start to finish, our shows were sold out, and it's not that I've never done anything that's sold out every time. Why this little silly play about a young woman dating, you know, an inappropriate yoga dude and a Zen practitioner who is so detached from connecting with her and, you know, needs to get up at 3 o'clock to meditate, but he can't, so he just wakes her up with the alarm clock and he won't get up and is rigid about how she uses his knife. And then the yoga guy goes off to India and comes back enlightened and runs into this whole problem that we see in the Neo-Advaita satsang movement, where there's a lot of talk about no separation, no self, and no me. So they get into arguments, and he begins, like, who is the you that's getting angry? There is no separate self. And who's getting angry? I'm getting angry. And these spiritual fights. And the play's slightly exaggerated and slightly not. There is a big rift on polyamory and different styles of relationship with spiritual constructs to describe them, and people just, I guess, needed to laugh and feel. And I would take it into the spiritual communities in Paris and Barcelona and lots of places that I've spent time. It still just amazes me that it's just a phenomena that needs to be named. We have enough relationship issues anyway, and what happens with Zen boyfriends or girlfriends is you get spiritually and psychologically sophisticated. And then you overlay your defense mechanisms with all of the spiritual speak. And when you overlay it with the language of truth, it gets really slippery. Who can argue with concepts of non-separation and the importance of meditation? And it becomes really like this whole spiritual neurosis, as if relationship issues weren't enough to deal with.
So how do you move from that to relationship as teacher, to be able to discern the difference? Because relationships certainly can be a great teacher if you're held that way. And I'm reminded of Anais Nin's comment that what we see in others says more about us than them, to hold that as a guiding principle and as a, you know, who needs a guru when you've got a relationship if you can actually hold what comes up in it?
If you can actually hold what comes up.
That's a big yeah.
And if the person you're with can actually hold a space for you to to deal with what comes up, and if they can.
We have to laugh at ourselves, too. Talk about humor as we begin to end this hour. Let's talk a little bit about humor. There's so many other things we could address and that are covered in your book, but it seems to me that humor would be a good way to wrap it up. What do you think the role of humor is in the spiritual path?
I gave a talk at Spirit Rock in the spring, and it was a talk about spiritual bypassing with John Wellwood, who was my friend and mentor in the subject. And I had been running the show all spring, and I got up there to do a Dharma discussion, and the first thing I said to the group is, supporting people to laugh the entire spring in the name of these principles, giving a spiritual talk feels a little bit dull. And then, I mean, the play really, I've always valued humor, and actually there's a lot of very good spiritual reasons why humor is valuable, because it, when we're laughing, our defenses are down, and we tend to be more open and spacious. So it's actually a very good vehicle for the wannabe teachers out there if you want to get
for health
in.
Too.
but actually that laughter is a very viable platform in order to make the body more penetrable to important principles. Also, just to engage these principles with joy and playfulness, and just bring it down to us. Years ago, when I was trying to learn how to use the humor in my spiritual talks, because I knew the value of it, I was researching spiritual jokes online, trying to find out what all the jokes were so I could use them. And there were not very many available at all, which was, I remember being quite amazed at the time. But the one that
your
was really
book.
Good, what do you call a Zen Buddhist monk who has schizophrenia? A man who is at many with the universe.
At many, oh, I love that. Mariana, it's so great to be with you. I'm really enjoying our interview. I have one last thing I would like you to share about, and that's the issue of practice. There's something about coming back again and again to the path, no matter where you go with it, that to me is very important. Can you say what you've learned about that in your years of study?
Yeah, and I write about it in the last chapter of the book. I honestly believe that there's no substitute for consistent, disciplined practice. And of course, it begs the question, how do we know what practice, and at what point in our life, and do we have to do the same practice for the rest of our life? And those are questions that are going to go beyond the scope of the interview. But the paths that say, when I go to see a teacher or check something out, and they say there's no practice, and there's no path, and there's nothing to do, I'm out of there. I would much rather there not be the need for practice.
Yes.
That all you're supposed to do is wake up in the morning and, you know, have coffee and croissants and do whatever you feel like. But I'm not convinced of that. I mean, I love to do that also. But practices, and not just practice for a few weeks or practice for a few months. And it's not that one's practice is going to be perfect, but there's a yoga sutra in classical yoga, and it basically says, you know, practice occurs through a long, long time, uninterrupted, consistent, in order for the fruits of the practice to become grounded. And whether it's a meditation practice, and even if we think we're bad meditators, and even if we can't practice 7 days a week, if we practice, when people ask me about beginning a meditation practice, I say, you pick something totally doable. Totally doable. That might be 10 minutes twice a week. And you stick with that. And when you're really grounded in that, then you add on a third day or an extra 5 minutes. But even if you did those 10 minutes twice a week for 5 years, surely one's life would be impacted for the better. Couldn't be for the worse. No matter how bad a meditator we thought we were or how many other things we did. And sometimes, in Sanskrit, it's tapas, and it's tapas is heat. And it's like it's a fire. So it might not even always matter what we're doing, but it's like the fire is like a little sacrifice. And it's a sacrifice of general laziness or unconsciousness to hone in our energy and attention and remember that we're availing ourselves to something. So maybe the practice is whatever it could be whatever, but just the remembering and the applying ourselves, I think, would bear a certain amount of fruits. And it has to, or otherwise every spiritual and religious tradition over the course of human history would be wrong, and I'm not inclined to think that they are.
I just want to appreciate you and express my gratitude for the work that you've been doing, mm-hmm. and that you continue to do, and the great joy that you seem to bring to your work. Mm-hmm. Thank you for being on Conversations.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Well, you've been listening to Marianne Kaplan, author of Eyes Wide Open and 7 other books. This one was on cultivating discernment on the spiritual path. Next week we'll have Pat Lind Kyle, Heal Your Mind, Rewire Your Brain. 17th we'll have Michael Negler, Search for a Nonviolent Future. And just thank you all for listening. I want to also appreciate Sacramento Natural Food Co-op's presenting the class Homemade Gnocchi, wherein participants prepare spinach gnocchi with white sauce, traditional potato gnocchi, and fresh ricotta gnocchi with pesto. Saturday, November 14th, 3 p.m., complete class schedule at SAC Food Co-op. Just want to say a couple community calendar things right now. 62 Classic Film, Lawrence of Arabia, plays in the main auditorium at the Del Oro Theater. Tuesday, 1 p.m., proceeds benefit the completion of the Del Oro Muro. www.sierratheaters.com. See Jane Dew and local Green Sierra hold their fall soiree into action. This Thursday, Apple Center for Sustainable Living in Nevada City, 6 to 8. There's a chance to meet and network with local female green activists and program organizers on how to get involved and make a difference. CJaneDew.com. Community Players in Nevada City presents War of the Worlds, a stage recreation of the 1938 radio broadcast of H.G. Wells' novel at St. Joseph's Cultural Center in Grass Valley. Performers are Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 274-7087. For more information, Sierra Mountain Coffee Roasters at 671 Malton Drive in Grass Valley, sponsoring a swing dance Friday from 7 to 10, 477-5282. Neighborhood Center for the Arts and Arts Center for Developmentally Disabled Adults is holding its For the Birds fundraising event, Miners Foundry, on Friday, 6 to 9. Local artists produce birdhouses and silent action. More information, 272-7287. Banner Mountain Artisans will hold their 6th annual sale in 6 a.m. Saturday, Sunday from 10 to 5, Nevada City Elks Lodge, Highway 49, featured works, 33 artists, www.bannermountainartisans.com. Coming Together in Unity, community event celebrating inspiration and meditation with music by Jane River, takes place Saturday, 3 to 5, Unity in the Gold Country, Grass Valley, 274-2463. Yuba River Charter School Educational Foundation prevents the Moondance 2009 benefit community celebration and auction this Saturday night beginning 5:30, Miners Foundry, 272-8078. Shabazz featuring Skyhawk Ali Khan and Rifat Sultana plus Fana Fiala perform this Saturday, 8 p.m. for the Center for the Arts, downtown Grass Valley. More information, stringsconcert.com. And Black Olive Babes perform an eclectic mix of Balkan, Romanian, Turkish, Sephardic, and American roots music. They'll play at St. Joseph's Cultural Center, Grass Valley, Saturday, 8 p.m. This is Michael Stone. You've been listening to Conversations on KVMR 89.5 FM, 105.1 FM in Truckee, translator K286 AN. Thanks so much for listening, and I will be back next week. Look forward to talking to you and having another conversation with you. Blessings.